Hello, everybody. How's it going? My name is Tristan, and welcome to Hablemos y Votemos, a podcast special with some amazing guests. And again, thank you for carving out this time to come talk to us. I want to start off saying he, him pronouns. I live in Battle Creek, and something that's inspired me this week is just being around conversations that are super awesome and inspiring. My mom is Costa Rican, and my dad is of German descent from Ohio. So that's a little bit about me. So next, Michelle.
Thank you. My pronouns are she, her, hers. My name is Michelle Salazar. I also use pronouns ella in Spanish. I'm currently residing in Battle Creek, Michigan as well. I work for the city of Battle Creek in the community development department as a community development specialist. And I get to, just do what I love every day and learn a little bit about government. And so I know what we're doing well and kind of where we're falling short. Something that inspired me this week was just being able to have these types of conversations multiple times this week, with people who are doing the work. It's just been really, really great. So thank you.
All right. And then next, we're going to introduce Joseph Alfonso. And could you give us a little bit about you and your background and what you're doing here?
Yeah. So I'm Joseph Alfonso. I am running for the 4th Congressional District here in Michigan, which is the U.S. House of Representatives. I am he, him, his. And I live currently in Holland. I'm a Marine combat veteran who grew up originally in South Bronx, New York. My wife is a Marine Corps veteran as well, who lives and is from also Zeeland, Holland area. What inspired me this week is actually today was canvassing here in Battle Creek. And a gentleman asked me, why skipping these doors and not knock on all the doors in the neighborhood? And I said, money, because it costs flyers. And, you know, it's significant. We have scant resources. But he appreciated me taking the step back and actually speaking with him and introducing myself and handing him the flyer and discussing what I'm doing. And he was very receptive for that. So that was kind of the one of the good highlights that usually don't really get too much off on the campaign trail.
Nice, thank you.
Thank you. And then I would like to introduce Kai DeGraff. Can you tell us a little bit about you and what you're doing here today?
Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me. I'm Kai DeGraff. I was born in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Pretty much lived in Michigan until 89 when I moved to Brooklyn, New York. And then for the last 25 years, the last 5 years living in Lowell Township. I'm back here in West Michigan. And 20 years before that in South Bronx. And little bit of affinity there with Mr. Alfonso.
Yeah,
we were talking about that. That's a lot of fun. So then I am from German-Dutch parents who came here with that wave of immigration that landed right around 1890. But son of immigrants nonetheless. And I have been lawyering for the last 26 years of my life, running my own private practice. I love what I do. I love being in law, and I know there's a lot of other questions about that. But what inspired me this week, I had to do an oral argument in front of the judges at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. And what inspired me this week is their grueling questions inspired me to be a better lawyer. So with that.
Awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate the hard work you're doing in the courtroom. All right, so now we're going to get to know a little bit more in depth about both Joseph Alfonso and Kai DeGraff. So first, we're going to start with Joseph Alfonso. I've had the pleasure of talking with him a couple times, and let me tell you, he is very inspirational. Just hearing his goals and what he's trying to accomplish really is amazing, and I applaud you. But let's get started out with, tell us your experience about growing up in New York as a youth?
Yeah, so my father is from the Dominican Republic. My mother's from Puerto Rico. And I'm one of six kids. And, you know, growing up in the South Bronx, people have this conception that they understand what it's like. It's like a mini city, or like a mini small town inside of a large city, the South Bronx is.
Okay.
It's a different culture. It's a different language. You know, you go from one borough, we call them, the five boroughs. You go from the Bronx to Brooklyn, it's a completely different dynamic, right? And so growing up there, you just have to really figure out people, learn body language and those kinds of things. It wasn't the easiest neighborhood, but it was home. You know, it's all we knew. And for me, it was just a matter of learning quick. You know, you have to be quick on your feet because growing up, you just walk into school. And it comes a certain point growing up, you're walking through the gauntlet, if you know what I mean. So it's kind of that lived experience that it was growing up as a kid, for sure.
And then you said your father is from the Dominican
Republic, yeah.
Dominican Republic. All right, perfect. Tell us what it was like growing up with a father that did immigrate to the United States and kind of that experience and if there's any, you know, boundaries, you know, hurdles, positives, all of that. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so, you know, I was born in the States. I was born in New York, but the predominant language we spoke at home was Spanish. Go to church, the Bibles were in Spanish. We spoke Spanish in church. So it made it a bit of a challenge to learn the language of English early on. So having a father from Dominican Republic, he had a ninth grade education level, really. And the only thing he really had to share with us, for the most part, is how to care for each other and how to work extremely hard. I mean, he showed us how to work as hard as I think till this day. I think it's normal. Most people think that is going like 400% above what normal people do. So it was definitely a challenge for him, but he paid his taxes. You know, he made sure like here are the things you're supposed to do as an American citizen: pay your taxes, work a job. If the job's not paying enough, you know, you shouldn't work extra hours at one job, just pick up another job, to, like things like that. This was his way of trying to give us guidance and advice on what to do. So that way because the reason he said that was because, what did he say? He said, if you work one job a lot more hours and if you work a second job for a little bit less hours, you still make time for family. So that was kind of my way of thinking, you know, that's how that went with him.
And so family's been ultra important since you were born, basically, in your life.
Absolutely, right? Yeah.
That's amazing, you know, hearing, you know, just the stories while we're off air, just about you and your family and you know, traveling from Michigan to New York with your, she was three, right, Lila?
Yeah. So that was a moment where, like, all right, my wife had a trip to go to Florida, and she was involved in the wedding. I did not want to be a part of that. That's a stressful process. So I took my then at the time 3-year-old daughter and myself only to drive to New York, which is a funny but terrible idea. Yeah. Funny story, terrible idea, because, you know, I went to drive at night, and the next thing you know it, you know, I'm like, oh, so I'm going to outsmart it. It's going to be nice. It's going to be calm. She'll fall asleep. The works. Then it was like a thunder lightning storm the entire way through Pennsylvania. Oh. And she's just crying her eyes out. Oh, and I like got halfway through the state of Pennsylvania, like, I give up. Like, I don't know if I'm going to make it. Then eventually it calmed down when I got to New York, which almost like a solace, right? Like, hey, we're here to take care of you, buddy. Welcome back. That's what it felt like. So
that's what family's for.
Yeah.
All right. So let's take it back a couple years from there. Reading your bio, you went to the military right out of high
yes.
school? Okay. So can you talk to us about kind of your career paths before you got to where you are now from then?
Yeah. So growing up, like, you know, I was talking about my dad. You know, he would wake up at 4 a.m. To get on a bus and a train after getting ready to go mop floors somewhere in the Bronx to show us how to work hard. And we do that from third grade till sixth grade, right before school, during the week.
Wow.
Just to show us what it's like to work your butt off and put in the hours and to let us know what a regular work day for everyday people is like. And then from there, we did labor construction work with a lot of the local unions in the city. And my dad was a laborer. You know, he spoke relatively good Spanish, but most of the guys who work in New York speak Spanish, I mean, pretty well. So growing up out of that, joining the service, and then becoming an electrician in the Marine Corps and doing other things as well, getting more involved with electrical diagrams and electric distribution systems, becoming more of an electrical engineer than anything else, and designing bases before I knew I was 28 at the time as well. So 20 to 21, I was helping design bases and provide guidance on humanitarian relief missions throughout the continent of Asia. So, you know, when you get out of the service, you try to figure out what exactly can you apply your skills to, right? So I come, you know, rebuilding cities and countries. I didn't think becoming an electrician again was the position for me, only because I had too much to offer. And like, I didn't want to take up a spot for somebody else who wanted to get into the sector and the trades. So I decided to take a step back from working with my hands and started working with my brain more, you know, behind a desk. So I started working in sales, and then sales evolved into getting recruited to working in banking, and then banking involved, you know, a lot of really good knowledge you learn in the financial system. And if I have to read the bank deck one more time, I might lose it. you have to read it every time you change a job or right. roles. And decided to go back into public service, and that's how I ended up at the city of Kentwood, working in the inspections department. You know, it was a pay cut and everything like that, but I just felt like it was the right thing to do. Because I wanted to share that knowledge with just everyday people, kind of break down the things that usually can cause confusion and frustrations with the process, you know, of pulling a permit, how you get your certificate of occupancy after your home's constructed, or a business that's having issues because they can't get their ability to open with their certificate of occupancy because like a parking lot didn't have a bond or something like that. So like just filling in the gaps that are usually been left there, only because it's a breakdown of communication. Because, you know, it comes down to, you know, people can't ask questions if they don't know what questions they need to ask.
Right. Yeah. And how many people that were Latino did work at the city of Kentwood at the time?
At the time, in my department, I was the only one.
Okay. Yeah,
the only Latino there. Yep.
And so did you see a lot of influx when people started recognizing that you did speak Spanish and could communicate with them?
Significantly, yeah. So it took me a while. I think I might have told Kai this, but I learned how to have a Cuban dialect worth of Spanish in order for me to communicate with a broad range of people, because it helped me to speak to the people who speak Mexican Spanish or Puerto Rican, Dominican, and so on. They can understand that dialect a lot easier than my New York Dominican, right. you know, Spanish. That's going to cause confusion. But yeah, the influx just started right away. I mean, people started coming in, asking questions about the treasurer, asking questions about the assessors. Even though we had, you know, a call system, I'm sure you have at Battle Creek as well. But that face-to-face is what really made them more comfortable doing it.
Yeah, and having that ability to communicate so freely, like you said, just helps so many people, and like finding more people that can speak either, you know, Spanish or any other like language here. Yeah. Like here we have a huge Burmese population. So having someone that can speak that language and help them through everything and, you know, like opening a business is already hard enough, let alone not being able to communicate in your native language. So it's very important to have those people in those positions.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like I have like so many similarities that I find in your story and like in your journey where you are now with my journey from just like, you know, I've been in banking. Like I also grew up from my grandparents. But what I really want to touch on is how you just talked about the importance of having someone in the room that speaks your language. And so I know, Kai, that you know a few different languages, and you know, you talked about your parents, you know, not being Spanish speakers. Or so can you tell me about like the importance like why you placed importance on speaking many different languages. Can you tell us like which languages you do speak? Kind of what kind of doors that open up for you, or some of the things that you were able to serve families with that you feel that maybe people who don't know another language can do for people?
I started learning languages at the age of 11. I started with Arabic, and I grew up speaking Arabic because my next door neighbors were from Lebanon. When I went to the university, I studied standard Arabic, and then in Brooklyn, spoke Arabic a lot, and since through the years in my practice. More recently, I attended the Arabic language program online at the Islamic University in Gaza, Palestine, for 2 years, and it was just excellent instruction. I started learning Spanish at right around 15, and then spent 6 months in Costa Rica.
Very nice.
Living and working in Costa Rica. And by the time I came back, I was quite fluent in Spanish. And Chinese language was something I also started back at the age of 16, 17. And then it became my major at the University of Michigan. Mm-hmm. And, of course, in my practice in Korean because my first wife was Korean. We were together 20 years, and I applied myself to learning that language as well. All of those languages are very important because Arabic, English, Spanish, Mandarin Chinese comprise, maybe 75-80% of all the world language speakers, you know, and Korean is big. But one thing that is, and it's something that you said, Joseph, and what you also said, Michelle, is that when you speak a language to somebody and you're in the room and suddenly, boom, they hear their language, it's like the identification, it's like, oh my God, yeah, another human being, you know.
The relief.
Yeah. Yes, it's like, oh my God, now I can communicate. And they're not even waiting around to see how fluent you are or to test the water. They just immediately start talking to you and letting you know what their concern is. And so there are people who come to me only because I can identify with them in their own language.
Right.
They will hire me only because I speak their language, as opposed to somebody who doesn't speak their language. They will not get hired by that person, by that client. For example, I'm a lawyer. It's I speak Spanish and probably Chinese every single day of my life. Every single day of my life, even if I'm not working, every single day of my life, which I try not to. When I'm in the Bronx or back in New York City, which I have to be frequently because I have an office in Manhattan, I speak Spanish just in my community, with the neighbors, with the people I live with in the building. You know, it's the way the world works. And so you have to. And this is, the world is getting smaller, not bigger. We are becoming more integrated as a people. We are becoming more one as a people. And with that, we have to linguistically identify with one another. It's just the way things work.
I think language is such a big part of just being more inclusive for people to feel like their voices matter. And that's what I want to be highlighting in this episode. And also kind of like why it's important to care about these issues, why the Latina youth should get involved. We were talking earlier about how we kind of like representation matters so much, just almost as much as being able to communicate with someone without a language barrier. And so another thing I wanted to touch on that you guys are both familiar with is how important is it for the Latina youth to be involved in politics or in local government or, you know, government as a whole? What kind of issues should matter to them? Pretty sure all of them, but are there any that are like, you know, we should really be paying attention to? why should we be seeing more Latina youth care about pursuing a career in politics?
I would say, you know, part of the reason why we have issues with immigration policy, because how many of our representatives have had people who had to immigrate here? You know, and that's a start. And like, I'm not saying that everybody in Congress has never had somebody immigrate here. That's not the case at all.
Of course.
But if there's people who are elected officials who've had, you know, family members, close relatives, who had to go through the grinder of getting the process, it's taken me 4 years and I'm still hung up with embassy nonsense, you know, just to get my father here, who doesn't have a criminal record. I don't have a criminal record, serves my country, did all the right steps, built the second house just to make space for him so they can't say there's no room, and I'm still waiting. You know, the process is just so convoluted. But again, it happens when people aren't there to really push back on some of these issues and make policy, not just fight for the people to get the 1, 2, 5 people every 4 years, you know, to immigrate here. How about we just have a policy that's just not so complicated? But the incentive to make those policies still isn't there. And it's evident. Because if it was there, it would have been done back in the 80s when they started the whole H2A, H2B programs. And those numbers haven't changed since 1983, 66,000 a year. So like, we need to start making those changes. We need to start making those efforts to improve the process. And it starts with having people who, in our case, being Latinos working in office. You know, the most common one is Central and Latin America, you know, South America. So, like, a lot of people come through there. Not because, like, they want a free pass. These are people who are going to work their butts off, you know. Who's framing the houses right now? You know what I mean? Like, who's mopping the floors in the restaurants? Who's buffing the floor in Meijer? Like, let's just start paying attention to who's doing the jobs and start realizing that those people need to be protected as well. The people who have done it the right way, who need somebody who's going to stick up for them, not just because, like, oh, they immigrated here, because guess what? Their kids are no longer immigrants. Their kids are American citizens.
Exactly.
And who are born here, you know? And I feel like having representation from the Latino community, just from that perspective, it'll stop this narrative that, like, you know, like in my case, there are people who think that myself and my family are still immigrating here somehow. Like, I was born here, about as American as it gets, you know? Like,
right.
So that's my take. Yeah, it helps remove that notion that it's okay to say, like, these people are just continuously immigrating here rather than just, we're here. We've been here. 2 going on like 7 generations in some cases.
That's absolutely right. You know, they are the people who are now becoming the community. By and large, America is changing. And no matter what you say in 10, 20 years from now, it's going to be much different than what it is today. There's a lot of pushback on that, as we see, you know, with the Trumpist and the right wing of the Republican Party, and even some folks in the mainstream Republican Party, although, you know, and even embarrassingly so within the Democratic Party in some areas. Yes. But that is the new population. And those folks become the people who need to be represented and who should be represented. Why? Because they're the population. They're the voters. Their children are the voters. You know, I look, you want to know what I see it as one of the questions, what inspired me to get involved in politics, other than moving back here and feeling like I really need to give something to West Michigan as opposed to, you know, being here, was AOC. When I look at Alejandro Ocasio-Cortez, and I heard her, and I heard Ilhan Omar, and I heard Ayanna Pressley talk about health insurance and for everybody, about, you know, what kind of housing we're going to have, about where we're going to spend our money. I said, oh my God, yeah. Holy cats. We've got people who are actually saying what we've wanted all along, who are now elected to office. Wow. What if there were more than just them? You know, then they would become the norm. Now, they say exactly everything that I've always wanted. So why not? I mean, that's what we need to do. I can be that person. I can be that person. And all of the Latino youth that are growing up in West Michigan today and all throughout Michigan, they can be those people.
Right.
They can be those people that are setting the agendas in the Michigan State Legislature, in the U.S. Congress. They can become the next presidents. They can be the people that are making the priorities. Why? Because this is theirs. This is their country, just as much as it is other people's as well. So that's the inspiration that I got. I was absolutely amazed. I said, yeah, I want that. I'm not going to vote. I'm going to, for anybody, I'm going to vote against somebody who isn't for universal health care. I'm going to vote for myself and other people who are for universal health care. Why? Because that's what I pay my taxes for. I don't want my tax money to be spent, yikes, on giving corporate tax breaks so that the middle class and poor people can just get poorer and struggle more and pay the lion's share of the taxes in this country. I want my taxes to go to education and to making sure that kids don't have to get all loaned out and debt laden by the time they graduate from college. That's where I want the money spent. We don't have to spend the money
right
on things that we don't want to. And that's why they should get involved in politics.
Yeah, to talk about the issues that matter to them. And that's the only way we can talk about those issues, whether it's in local government or national, is by being in those chairs.
Yeah. Exactly.
Joseph, could you tell us a little bit about why you decided you want to run for office?
I have many reasons, you know, and I can share the two. I can share two of them. So my daughter, Lila, she's 8 years old now. Last year on the side of the road, protesting for reproductive rights, she had a body, my body, my choice sign. It was screaming, my body, my choice. And I felt proud as a dad, like growing up in the Bronx, you get taught how to protest. You get taught how to stick up for your rights and how to stick up for yourself as an individual and as a collective. And then I started thinking to myself, are you trying as hard as you can? Are you trying as hard as your father who came from Dominican Republic with limited education, just a work ethic? Are you trying as hard as he did? Are you trying as hard as your mom who had a baby in belly, a baby in hand, as hard as she did to give us just a chance? Both of them coming here with this idea of a country and a community that gave them the afforded them the opportunity to just come here and roll the dice, right? Put in the work, get in the hours. And I said, no, I could do more. You know, like we might be living better than I lived as a kid. And she might be living a pretty normal life by the standard. But that's no guarantee her future might be that way. It can be a lot better. I could do a lot. I could leave the house less of a mess when it's her time to take over. You know, because at this stage in the game, we're raising an adult. She's going to be 10 for the next year and a half, you know. So I have to make sure that I finish out my time strong and then she's able to enjoy the rest of her life. Now, the next part of it is my friends who I served with, guys who, you know, I had a deployment with me. I had harder deployments than me, and watch the exit of Afghanistan. Difficult, but we all knew it was going to be ugly. There was no way to get out of there easily, but we all knew it was going to be ugly, and we all knew it was still the right thing to do. It took stones to do it, to put your name onto there and just deal with the consequences. And the other thing is that I had, you know, a roughly 60 of my Marine Corps friends who just wanted a guy they knew unequivocally who would not falter, who can't be bought, who can't be swayed, and he can't be intimidated. It takes a hell of a lot to intimidate somebody like me, I promise. Mostly because my goal is to be there for the community, you know, not improve myself. And they kept asking me, like, we need you up in D.C. so that way we know we can go to D.C., and protest for veterans' rights or social equity or anything. And we know that you would stand right there next to us every single time. So you're damn straight I will.
Seeing AOC and Ayanna Pressley and Ilhan Omar talk and vote for the things that I care about, I said, I can do that. I can do that in West Michigan. I can do a good job. I can. I can be honest about it. And I can do my term. People want me back in there. They'll tell me. If not, I can go on and do something else. But I want to give to the community and in a different way. I've never held office before. I've just been lawyering for the past 26 years, and prior to that, doing a lot of community service. And but I want to do this for a change.
And is this your first time running for office as well?
Very first.
Very first. And Joseph?
I did an exploratory run for county treasurer in 2020 to kind of see how the sausage was made, you know?
Yeah.
So, well, quite smaller office than congressional, but still, you know, but something to learn.
Definitely didn't discourage you.
No, no. Too stubborn for that.
Actually, I could correct that. I'm actually a precinct delegate.
Yeah. And you're elected official, technically. Right. No, don't negate that.
That's correct. Yeah. Precinct delegate and a precinct captain. So those are also very, very new and recent. Mm. Yeah.
Talk about some of the challenges that the Latina community is facing in Michigan, how you'll address them in office, and how different generations can, I guess, come together to tackle some of the issues that are similar yet different.
Well, the way I see it over in West Michigan, like in Grand Rapids in particular, and Lowell Township and the communities around there, we have a real large influx of Central Americans. Mm-hmm. And these people really need a help with becoming more involved in the community economically and socially. So linguistics or language training and assistance, learning, a job training. These are just amazingly hardworking people, extremely hardworking. And I know that they would be very receptive and very grateful if they were offered opportunities for more education, more job training. And so I think we really need to provide that. I think state government should allocate more money to those areas so that they can get those services that they need and become more involved. And not through either racism or isolationism, exclude them from participating, but get them more involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And to build on what Kai was saying, I think zooming a little in and then back out, as candidates for all offices, Spanish literature, Spanish flyers,
yes.
Spanish mailers, easily translatable to Spanish websites. You know, things that make them feel less dumb. Like, don't make the Latino community feel more dumb than people already make us feel on a daily basis.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of my biggest things. We try to make sure that we hit it right and get the language correctly. The other thing is having better funding for all those programs, but also better funding for our elections. Maybe have the ballot say vota and vote. You know, just something that basic. There's a, like, City of Holland has 25% Hispanics.
Wow.
City of Holland. Not many people understand that. Hartford Township, massive Hispanic community. Pullman, up here in, I believe, in the more northern portion of this congressional district, 42% of the high school graduates Hispanic.
Wow.
So the community's there. These are people who are American born, just happen to have different lineage. But these are Americans, you know. So we should have these people be informed by having the funding for our elections. I'll do whatever I can at the federal level to make sure that happens. So that way it's similar to the ballot looks like in Florida. You know, they have two languages, right? Mm. Spanish and English.
Or New York.
Yeah. Mm. So in order for them to feel like they're included, in order for them to say like, oh, I saw so-and-so's name. I've heard them speak. I've read their material. What office are they running for though? Mm. Right?
Yeah.
Like, Congreso, close enough. You know, Senador, getting there. You know, Gobernador, still kind of like, okay, you know. some of the words match up with some of the English words. Then once you start getting the county commissioner, priests and delegates, you know, it becomes really pretty shitty to try to figure out what exactly you're trying to look at and vote for. So I think something like that, just being able to ensure that they can read it and understand it, they're going to inform themselves. We just have to make sure that we give them the opportunity to be informed.
Absolutely. And one thing that really stuck out to me is you saying, like, let's not make the Latinos feel dumber than they already are pretty much being told that they are, right? I mean, as a mother or a son from a mother that came from Costa Rica and, you know, knows two languages, I don't know how to speak Spanish. And I'm like, that's like amazing to be able to communicate outside of your native language so, you know, fluently. And, you know, every time I, you know, hear my mom speak in English and then Spanish and like switch effortlessly between who she's talking, it's just like, wow, it takes so much intelligence to be able to do that. And I think a lot of people look down at people, not just Spanish speakers, but immigrants that are learning English as a second language as like, oh, you don't know English. You must be stupid, dumb. Like, no, they probably know English better than people that were born here as their first language. And B, it just takes so much intelligence to learn another language. Like I said, I don't know it, a second language, and I would consider myself smart. So
yeah,
I'm just like, wow, like it's a next level when it comes to that.
Yeah.
I always hear people who are migrating to America from another country. They're looking for opportunities and they're looking for, you know, either a better way of life or a different way of life, but they want to come here and make this their home, or else they wouldn't be here, is what I've experienced when talking to people who are migrating here. They are trying to adapt this way of life and bring a little bit of their culture with them too, like, you know, and maintain that culture here. So they're trying to learn English, and I don't think that I try to do the best that I can when I'm interpreting, when I see a family who is struggling to speak English. I'm trying to put, you know, steps in place, at least in my workplace, that say, hey, the resources that you're trying to access and the information that you need from me to help you out in living your life, you deserve this and you deserve to understand this. And so let me help you out, like you said, translating documents, having people that speak the language in the room with them until they learn the language, the English language. We can definitely learn to be more compassionate, to be to meet people halfway, have a transition period. Like, if you are migrating here for whatever reason it is, you are now part of our society, and it only really benefits us to learn this person's culture, this person's like, help them succeed, because then we succeed as a whole. And so it's just really, I don't know, kind of uncomfortable for me to feel like people don't want to see other people succeed. And then on top of that, make them feel small when, I mean, I think you said it, Kai, like we all migrated, everyone has migrated to America for an opportunity. And so I'm just like really excited to see that people want to get involved, for you guys to be running, you know, and, you know, hopefully then get elected, that we can see people that look like, I can see someone that looks like me in office, especially because your background, like I found so many similarities with your background. You know, I've worked in banking. I've served in the nonprofit world. I've been a healthcare provider, and now I'm in city government, you know, in City Hall here in Battle Creek. And I'm like, what next? Like, I'm always hungry for more. I'm always hungry to learn how I can give back to my community and, you know, carry these experiences that people are sharing with me and take it to the top, like, and create more, equitable access to things. And so it's like, what kind of advice would you give, you know, someone like me who, or Tristan, like if tomorrow we decide like, hey, we want to run for office, but we haven't been a politician before or filled a seat in that realm.
research like crazy and find the people that not just know the system or just like have experience, find the people that you know have the experience and the knowledge that you need, but also feel like you can trust, because it can burn you. It can burn you pretty bad if you don't find the people you know you can trust to teach you the things you're supposed to do the right way. You know, you're going to have growing pains. You're going to have your own mistakes. You know, I've asked other candidates, the first question I asked them is like, what are the things you did wrong? You know, but then when you're doing that, you lose sight of the things that you need to do right. You know, so you have to make sure you keep that in mind and swing big. If swing big means you run for treasurer, commission, senator, whatever, swing big. Whatever you feel capable of, run for it. Because people are going to distract you, right? But the fact of the matter is, if people don't swing big, then a farmer from Montana wouldn't become the only Democratic senator. A small town mayor in Indiana wouldn't be holding his own on the stage in the presidential debate. Bartender wouldn't be holding her own against a very well-established incumbent of 14 years. You know, there's the list goes on. A nighttime nurse in Illinois who just wanted her community to do well wouldn't unseat an incumbent. So it's there. It's not anomalies. You just have to learn what is your passion, whether it be school board, whether it be commissioner, whether it be city. You know, there's so many roles that you can fill and apply yourself to. And no seat is considered like beneath or above you. You have to ensure that you remind yourself of one really important fact. It's not about you. It is not about you. Doesn't matter how big your ego feels or it makes you feel good about yourself. The faster you realize it's not about you, the easier it is to do the job.
That's powerful.
Yeah, I would totally agree with everything that Joseph said. In realizing that it's not about you, you identify what issues that you care about that other people care about too. You have to know that when you get into office, you're going to be just slammed with lots of work, stuff that's not easy. You know, you're going to be creating law. That is your role as a writer of laws. Laws that are supposed to be designed to help people like you and me, the citizens of all of our communities. And unless we keep that in mind, what the priorities are, we're going to do lawmaking just for the sake of it, and we become careerists, we become corrupted because it's our career, you know, well, I can accomplish this by doing this deal, you know, politically, and I'll be able to ride another 4 years in office or whatever the case may be. So I would say make sure if you want to get involved that number one, it's not because you want a job in politics. It's because you want to do something for the people that live in your neighborhood or your community, your city, and you're passionate about the things that are important to other people as well. You keep that in mind, and then everything flows from there. And I also agree with aim big, because just look at the people that have gotten into office. I mean,
playbook is gone. There's no playbook.
There is no playbook anymore, especially after Donald Trump. Yeah. The playbook is gone. Integrity is gone, unfortunately, in so much of our elections. But, you know, we have to keep democracy safe. And so we have to keep it real. And by keeping it real, I mean, keep it honest. Keep it about the passion and the things that you care about. And as long as you're doing that, you'll end up in the right place.
And don't apologize for your passion.
I think both of what you guys just said in this conversation, previous conversation, has really stuck out to me about you both are just like, you know, you said it earlier, if I, you know, don't get elected again, or if I don't get elected to begin with, like, I have something else that I can fall back on. This isn't like, you're not looking for this to be your career path. And so it kind of brings back, like you said, that integrity of why you're running for office. Mm-hmm. Like exactly you said, right. It's not about you.
No.
So that's, I love that. Entering the last couple of questions of the night. Again, thank you guys for being here. What is something that has been super rewarding in your journey of running for office so far?
I would say the number of people you meet and being able to speak to, I mean, thousands at this point, probably tens of thousands to be quite honest. And just seeing how many people have so many similarities, you know, and I try to like really immerse myself and figure out how we can all, like, what are the things that we can agree on, right? Like, what are the things that, like, you know, that matter most? And like, I started getting into the weeds a little bit. I started thinking about like policy initiatives, funding things. And then I kind of went, well, back to what you learn as a kid, your morals and ethics and values, right? You want to make sure your government doesn't make things harder for you. You want to make sure that they're building things towards the future. And once those two things are done, leave me the hell alone. You know, stay out of our business, out of our private lives, decisions. That's quite it. Those three right there, I can say in any community. So that's probably been the most rewarding. Finding the common ground, you know, it was not easy. There is so many conversations where, you know, things get heated, things get tough. And you know, for federal races, I mean, like any other office, don't get me wrong. All their offices are valuable by all measure. They just have this idea that the federal race is so above and beyond what they're supposed to be expecting from, you know. So the most rewarding thing is definitely talking to all these people and then sharing my story. It's something I knew would allow people to feel more comfortable sharing theirs, but just and then affirming them that, like, yeah, my story, you know, in the grand scheme of things, the full one might be a little bit tougher than other people's story, but pain is pain. Struggle is struggle. You know, if I didn't get enough of a tuna out of a can as a kid, that was my struggle. Right. Because it was like, oh, I just didn't make it enough. You know, we just didn't have enough for that. And then my daughter, you know, I forgot to cut the crust off her bread, you know, different scenarios. But that's her struggle. So like it's just crazy to see how so many people can really come down to those three things and just feel involved and feel heard and feel listened to and seen. So I think that's kind of it for me there.
Yeah, I would agree with that. The commonality, the coolest thing about running for office for me has just been meeting so many different people, getting to know more of the community that surrounds me, and recognizing again and again and again the commonality of so many of the issues that are important to all of us, you know, like water and really, you know, good food, that we have access to it, that we're able to consume it, and that we're not just paying for stuff because somebody is making money off us, you know. And I mean, these are things that are important to everybody, you know. And then, of course, stability. Everybody wants to have a roof over their head. They want their families to be safe. They want to educate their children. These are all things that are important to all of us. And I think once we clear away and peel away these labels that people either will give us or we ascribe to ourselves mistakenly, then we can see, look, this is the way to get to that. Because, I mean, nobody can disagree with those priorities as being probably the most important. I think Republicans and Democrats could all agree on that. But what they're going to do, again, because so many of them are careerists, they're going to say, well, yeah, but how do we get there? And they're going to wheel and deal about how do you get to achieve those goals? We can only get there like this. And then they politic on, you know, why we need to employ this means as opposed to my opponent's needs. But so I really don't see them keeping that honest, but definitely the commonality. And I think we could all do a lot more to agree. I think there's a lot more room for agreement about how we get there. But I just think that people are too busy politicking around it. And that's why. I mean, you probably have more experience around that than I do. But, I mean, that's my sense of it.
Yeah. And one last thing to add. I canvass anywhere. I'm not afraid to do it. And I canvass one neighborhood of a predominantly Hispanic community it came to be. And a lady was like, oh, you speak Spanish? I said, yes. And you're running for Congress? I said, yes. And she said, then your mom did really good. And just like that really hit, you know? So for me, it's been both a challenging year, but just I'm grateful for some of these people I've met so far.
That's great.
Thank you for sharing.
We're almost out of time for our episode, but one of the, I think maybe like heavier questions for me is, so here in Battle Creek, we have an ICE detention center. Could you guys maybe talk about like how you feel about ICE detention centers? So some people want to abolish ICE. Some people, you know, have the, opposing view on that. Anything that you guys want to talk about for that, like some of the things that we should consider maybe locally?
Well, I would say that like we can do a lot better job than putting people in detention centers. You know, like we can have a holding facility of some kind, really like a prison for people. Like, yeah, they broke the law. We could just be like, all right, let's just get them through this pass through system where they get checked, screened, whatever, and send them back where they're supposed to go. But like having a full-on detention center for what, crossing an imaginary country borderline? Like we need to have more realistic expectations here. And I'm not saying that because I'm a, you know, let's fully abolish ICE. Let's try to at least be realistic here because the other side's not going to agree to abolish ICE. Let's just be factual. And then try to figure out how can we change it to improve the system rather than costing, because how much does it cost to even house an individual inside of an ICE detention center, you know?
A lot.
Yeah. If I'm not mistaken, it's roughly $42,000 a person. So we can spend $42,000 a person, or we can spend like, I don't know, 11, anything less than $42,000 a person in order to get the process a little bit better and make it a little bit more streamlined. So that way the people who just thought they were coming here were misinformed, we say, nope, you're just misinformed. Let's reroute you back to where you need to go. And this is how you do it the right way. Because if you never knew anybody who immigrated here, you're not going to understand that most of those people are going to go, oh, my mistake. You know, we want to make sure we do it right. We thought this is the way you do it because that's how we were shown. Mm-hmm. So I'm not a fan of ICE considering, you know, I've experienced my father being deported. So like, and years later, I found out that the way they did it was just absolutely horrific. My youngest brother at the time was 9. ICE police officers just came up to him, said, you're so-and-so. He said, yes. They got him in the car, drove off, left my 9-year-old brother in the street by himself. Mm-hmm. That's the policies of the early 2000s. I pray to God that it's gotten better, but we still need to do better. So that's something we can work on for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when it comes, I agree with you, Joseph. The reality is Section 236 of the Immigration and Nationality Act requires that some people who commit certain crimes be subject to mandatory detention. So if that's true, and there's always going to be a unit or an agency of people within the federal government under the executive branch who are going to implement that detention, then we decide where we detain them. Now, I can tell you as an attorney that I would rather have somebody nearby in an ICE detention center than at some county jail that's been contracted simply so that county employees could get jobs. And I'm not talking about an ICE detention center that is a private facility that's contracted out. There's many of them. And they're some of the most scandalous money-making operations, the scummiest, and I'll say that, scummiest operations in the United States. Large for-profit prisons. And it used to be drugs, and now it's immigrants. That's the money-making game. They profit off detaining people. So let's take it away from private prisons. Let's take it away from county contracts so all these political favors aren't being swung their way, so that jails like Calhoun County Jail can get the contract so that they can, you know, supply those jobs. And let's let ICE be responsible for running their own facility with the tax dollars that are allocated to them for detaining only those people that are subject to mandatory detention under Section 236. And not willy-nilly going and hunting down these DACA kids or other people who fit a profile, and that's why ICE tagged them in the first place, either on the road or at an airport. And it happens all too often. You mentioned that when they were picking up your dad and left your 9-year-old brother there. And no, they didn't care. And there's a lot of officers that I have to deal with all the time who still don't care. They have this really sort of...
like hunter-predator type mentality.
Yeah, Nazi Boy Scout robot attitude, you know, about how they go about their job.
Extremely unprepared, too.
Like, totally they're not, unprepared. They're lack trained. Of knowledge of yeah. the job. It's like, you know, unfortunately, some of the police officers we encounter out there. You know. But so, yeah, I don't want, I acknowledge that some people under the law, and there's no judge that's going to overturn, I mean, Congress has to change Section 236. So while it's there, while it is the law, there will be some branch of agency government under the executive branch that is going to implement mandatory detention, and they're going to put people in detention, and they're going to deport people under Section 240. It's just the way the law operates. But certainly we can put limitations on it, and we can make it lawful. And I think what we need to do, too, is get rid of just sort of this vigilante culture within ICE. I don't really know how to do that other than extensive training and maybe hire better. You know, maybe they just really have to look at who they're hiring. And the same thing with law enforcement, you know, in so many of our jurisdictions. But
yeah, I agree. Thank about you. The hiring. Really take a look at the people that are getting hired into public service and stuff like that.
Well, Again, appreciate you guys so much. This has been so awesome. You guys both are just amazing. So thank you again for coming out here tonight and just spending time to talk with us and being flexible with the plans as they change. So again, thank you very much. And is there anything you guys want to leave? One last thing before we go?
First, I want to say thank you both. I mean... Yeah, us as candidates, like as Kai knows, like we have to be flexible. There's no sometimes you just have to be malleable in certain situations. So thank you guys and for having here at Cafe Rica. Just want to say that there's a lot of things that we need to work on, but we can get there by doing it together. You know, there's about roughly 65,000 Latino Hispanics in this 4th congressional district. Low voter turnout. Now that's on part of the candidate's job to give them a reason to vote. Help us get some of these things passed. Help us by being there, showing up, volunteering, getting involved, getting informed, because you never know. You never know what idea that we were missing that your community needed, but we never heard. So we want a reason. If you want a reason to vote, give us your reason why. You know, so like we can do the job. We can do the work. Your job is to tell us what you need. Our job is to get it done. So, but thank you guys again for taking this time out too.
Yeah, thank you very much. I really want to thank, I just met you, Justin and Michelle. Thank you. And it's been really nice meeting you, Joseph. We've met each other twice now, I think.
Yeah.
And Vanya, thanks for handling the video.
Sure.
You know, I really, really do appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity to get the message out there to your listeners. Have a good evening.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right. That is it for Votamos y Hablamos. That's backwards, but.
Hablemos y Votamos.
Yeah, remember to vote by November 8th.
Vote, vote, vote.
Yes.
Because our lives depend on it.
Absolutely. Yes.